Hello and welcome to the University Guy podcast. I'm David Hawkins. Now, usually on this podcast, I focus on international things, typically looking how students from one system will apply to another country's universities. But today, I'm focusing on the domestic. It's been really, really interesting to follow the higher education debate over the last few years here in the UK. And one particular person has been a very influential figure in that debate. As he decided to take a slight step back from the cut and thrust of Delhi debate, I decided that I really had to get his perspective on where things have come from and where indeed things might go to. So please do enjoy my time chatting with the headmaster of Whitgift School, Mr. Chris Ramsey. My guest today is someone who from time to time seems to be involved in intimately in all sorts of debates to do with higher education in the United Kingdom, and I'm very fortunate over the last couple of years to be able to speak with him at various conferences and forums, and very impressed by the level of knowledge and work he's done. So Chris Ramsey, the headmaster of Whitgift School, thank you so much for joining me.
Very good to speak to you, David, and indeed all the listeners. Good to be here.
Fantastic. Thank you. So Chris, do you mind, just for listeners who might not have come across the work that you've done in the field of higher education in your career, just give a little bit of background about how you've got yourself kind of in this position of being really well known in this sort of interface between UK schools and UK universities?
Yeah, well, you're very kind, David. I'm not quite sure how well known I am. But so one of the things that the Headmasters Conference, Headmasters and Headmistresses Conference and the Girls Schools Association have sort of really promoted over the last several decades is the university's group, the university's committee, which I've sat on now for 11 years and chaired for the last 7 years. And the role of this committee, which also includes some representatives from the maintained state school world and indeed various other organizations. The role of the committee, and we think it's the only one of its type, by the way, is to be a conduit between schools and universities. We meet every term in a university, a different university each time, and our role is really to spread information both ways, so to inform universities what's happening in schools and to inform schools how the university world is changing, because the people in schools, the advisors, very often they're a little bit behind the times. They're thinking about admissions and so on and so forth from when they did it, so they need the sort of up-to-date advice, and universities need to know what's going on in schools. So I suppose it's a kind of scrutiny, a holding to account, which is part of our work, and that information. So it's fascinating work. It's a great privilege to work with universities and to get to know them, and we've always found that universities are really keen to understand schools better, and that's been one of the great privileges of the last, as I say, just over 10 years.
Great. I mean, it really is it's a fascinating institution, and the work you do is really well appreciated, certainly from those on my side of things who kind of work with a lot of schools. I hear very positive things. I think it might be useful just for those who might not understand some of the UK context a little bit to explain the fact that you mentioned HMC in there, the Headmasters and Mistresses conferences, that this is not a committee of advisors, of heads of 600 of college counsellors, to use international term.
But
you know, I'm stealing 40 minutes of your time today, Chris, and you are the headmaster of a very big school, and actually the people who are doing this are themselves the head teachers, the principals of other schools around the UK.
That's absolutely right, and that's very important to us, because when, as a head, so there's about 25 people on this committee, and as I say, mainly running independent schools, and then some of them, there are some people who run state schools who we co-opt onto the committee because we think it's really important it doesn't just have this sort of independent school bias. So the point is, we're going back to our schools after the meeting, and we've really got the authority to say to our staff, look, this is what's happening in admissions, this is what's happening with the student experience, and if the schools need to make changes to what they're doing, to how they're preparing students, in a sense, we've got the authority to make that happen. And of course, we then spread the word to the other heads in our region, and they've got that authority, if you like, rather than just being a group of heads of sixth form or advisors who wouldn't necessarily have that authority. So we think that's a really important aspect. That's right.
Yeah, I agree, and particularly in the context of how at some schools in the UK, higher education advising is probably still a long way behind the quality that I think you and I would both like it to be seen, to have heads really understanding that, as you say, this is not the world that was the case when they applied, you know, handwriting the UCA form, or I was the last year that had the wonderful thing where you had to have it printed onto a sticky back piece of paper and then stick it onto the paper form. So,
oh my goodness, yeah. that's going back a bit. But you know, the really interesting thing that I've noticed over the years I've been doing this work, in particular the last 7 or 8 years, I remember about 7 or 8 years ago, the committee sort of took a good hard look at itself and said, we spend all our time talking about admissions, which is, by the way, one of the big besetting sins of UK higher education. Yeah. The amount of time, energy, and angst devoted to the admissions process. And we said, you know, we spend all this time talking about admissions, fair admissions, and how can our school students get the best route to the right universities, and how can universities make it all fair? And then we don't think at all about what the experience is like when they get to university. So we've had a big shift in our work. We still spend a lot of time talking about admissions, but we've increasingly been speaking with universities about what is the experience like for the students. And I've really noticed a shift in universities' thinking as well, as higher education has expanded so much in the UK, that universities need to give more thought to what does the experience feel like? What's the teaching like? What's the care like? What's the accommodation like? All of those things. So that's been a really interesting change.
Yeah, I reflect on that time. I think when we were both at the Festival of Higher Education at the University of Buckingham last year, yeah, there was sort of debates on that kind of topic. And I remember, I think probably 5 or 6 years ago, hearing you speak on this kind of topic, and it may have been you or someone else sort of making the point that as that higher tuition fee came into the UK, and you know, though it's a nominal amount, it does make people think more like consumers, that those who have been involved in private schools are used to dealing with parents as consumers, and it does change the paradigm a little bit, that you are expecting a service as a result of that. And so I think, particularly the last couple of the advising conferences I've been to that you and the committee have organised, I definitely picked up on that theme. That's obviously one strand of things, and I think probably sort of the mental health things that come into that. I know you've been active about sort of sharing information about that. What other key developments have you seen in this kind of role of liaising between schools and universities during your time as chair?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of other big things. If I just return on that fees and consumerism, I do think it took universities by surprise, and I think that a number of university people have quite honestly said in the last couple of years that when tuition fees went up to £9,000. And I remember we had a meeting at that time at the University of Leeds when the Brown report was published. And my goodness, you know, tuition fees are going to triple from £3,000 to £9,000. And we as independent school heads immediately started thinking universities are going to have to think of themselves as the providers of a paid for service. And I don't think universities twigged that for quite a long time. I think they have now, but I think it took them a long time, and completely understandably. You know, we might talk about a bit more about that, you know, in a minute. But so there's been a sort of cultural change, but actually, funnily enough, in some ways, things haven't changed. And we thought at that stage, well, do you know what? Some of these smaller universities are going to go to the wall. Yeah. You know, there'll be 20 fewer universities in the UK in 10 years' time. That was around about 2011, 12, wasn't it? Around about then. And do you know, it hasn't happened. So in some ways, the HE sector is very resilient in the UK. But I mean, in terms of sort of things that have changed over the time that I've been involved in this world, I guess that that whole area of teaching student experience and so on and so forth that we just mentioned is one area. There's been some, I would say, innovation. So one of the really fascinating days that I had just last year was visiting the new university in Hereford, ENMITE, the new model in technology and engineering. There's been the new College of the Humanities in London. So there's been some innovative new institutions. But, do you know, not that much, really. It's been quite limited innovation. And I suppose the whole area of student expectations, which is part of that sort of cultural point earlier, I think that has changed over the years. Part of that, as I say, sort of cultural expectation of perhaps something a bit more. And that's both good and bad. I mean, it's good when consumers hold their institutions to account. But on the other hand, university should be about independence, and it shouldn't just be given to you on a plate. And I suppose the biggest area of development, which has been a theme through all the time I've sort of been involved in this world, has been the whole question of fair access to university, widening participation, underrepresented groups, all of that whole sort of piece, which I would say the university sector has still not quite come to terms with what it thinks on it.
Yeah.
It's a very, very complex area.
Well, indeed. Actually, we're sitting here now. We're just, you know, a couple of days after all the Oxbridge decisions came out.
Yeah.
And yeah, you and I will have both seen these wonderful stories of relatively new schools in serving, you know, disadvantaged populations. And I'm sure someone will crunch the numbers soon, but it will, you know, the top sort of three sending schools to Oxbridge this year will not be the same three schools that it was 10 years ago and had been for eons before that. This whole issue is changing. For people who are kind of sort of unaware of these kind of things, you know, the debates about who should get into universities and things like contextual admissions, polar data, and I think one of the things that has to exercise the time of a lot of HMC heads, Oxbridge, you know,
yep,
where has that debate gone, and where do you think we stand now in terms of this kind of idea of fairness to universities?
Yeah. Well, it's very complex, and the if we kind of step right back from it and think about UK higher education in its sort of really big picture, one of our big problems as a sector in the UK is, I mean, Oxbridge is one of our big problems, if you like. The UK only had two universities for so long that when others came along late 19th century and then obviously big explosion in the mid 20th century, everybody thought that the real way to do a university was Oxbridge, and everybody else is a bit second class.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of deeply ingrained. And of course, it is true that the Oxbridge model, which is residential, not that other universities aren't, but it's very sort of closely residential quads where you all live around one sort of area and very individual teaching, one-to-one, two-to-one. It is completely different to everything else.
Yeah.
And therefore, it follows from that access to Oxbridge is kind of always going to be prized above almost anything else. And it's all very well for people to say, you know, we will have been saying to the boys at my school who weren't successful, look, you know, it's fine, there are other great places, and they'll say, yeah, I know, sir, I know. But somewhere underneath there is a disappointment that somehow not being accepted into Oxbridge means you haven't quite got the gold prize.
Yeah.
And that's very, I mean, it's just deeply ingrained. And the other Oxbridge problem is it is a zero-sum game. These are universities which have not expanded, have no interest in expanding, because of that model of being very personalized, very individualized. So in terms of fairness there at that very top elite end, if you then say, and I think it's absolutely right, by the way, to say, look, we do have to spread our net wider. We just can't have a sort of privileged elite always taking all the places. Then there are going to be tensions around those who are really able to flourish in the top institution, who've had a great, let's say, independent education, but who can't be fitted in alongside the very, very brightest from the very most selective schools, and some others who haven't had those advantages and who Oxbridge wants to open their access to. It's a tension which is kind of inherently unfair.
Yes.
And that's what we're grappling with at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you. You completely 100% about it. And it's such a challenging situation for people to overcome and to understand the nuances of it. And I think part of the real complexity, and I think, you know, again, not to compliment you and the work of the committee, but where it's really nice to have this organisation that's out there is the media latch on to Oxford and Cambridge stories so quickly as well. And then to be able to have, you know, some necessarily corrective into there, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I applied to Oxford the year after the infamous Laura Spence story, which for those who don't know, it was the then, I think it was the incoming Prime Minister at the time, Gordon Brown, you know, publicly said, isn't it terrible that this very talented girl from the northeast of England hasn't got in? I forget whether it was Oxford or Cambridge, and massive media splash. And actually, you know, I think she got in to study a completely different subject at another very good university. And you think now looking back, I think, well, probably they made the right decision. But I would imagine that your email inbox, whenever there's sort of an Oxbridge story, gets many more requests from journalists than if it were something, you know, another very good UK university you've done something a little bit that getting media attention.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think one of the drums that we've tried to bang on the group that I've been on, which again I would always really stress, and I kind of feel it's one of my failures that it hasn't got more traction, is the clear statement that if you use school type as a way of trying to achieve fairness, that is deeply flawed. So again, listeners may or may not sort of know about the if you're a university admissions department and you're dealing with obviously thousands of admissions and you want to achieve sort of social fairness, so most talented applicants, but not just from the most privileged backgrounds, you've got various tools at your disposal. You can look at their postcode and see, you know, what sort of kind of area they live in. You can look at their school. And there's not a huge amount of other things. Some universities will ask questions about family background, but you're starting to pry into some quite sensitive data. So, you know, postcode data is pretty fair as an assessment of the sort of family background. But school type, independent or state, which is the only division you can really see clearly on from an application, is a really unfair, in our view, way of going about sort of achieving fair access, because the independent sector in the UK is only educating about 7 to 10% of youngsters, and yet it's a very diverse sector, with some very selective schools, some not particularly selective schools, and some schools like mine, which gives half its places free to underprivileged kids anyway. And the state sector, which is at some 90-ish percent of the applicants, is, again, incredibly diverse. There are state grammar schools, which are incredibly selective and pretty socially exclusive. There are state academies, which are often, you know, really good areas where they're putting a lot of resource into education, and then there are state comprehensives, which could be fantastic or could be very disadvantaged. So universities which summarise their fairness in terms of school type, I always think is missing the point, and it saddens me greatly that my own former university, Cambridge, have sort of just given in to the media pressure and talk in their headlines about the percentage of students from state schools, as if that was somehow a sort of intellectually sound way of making a judgment.
Yeah,
that's the rant over.
No, this is the nice thing, and I think the lovely thing about the HMC and GSA Universities Committee, that it is heads doing it, is there is nuance here. I think how I fell in love with the world of university advising is the complexity and helping families through that complexity. But so yep. often it can be reduced to a very simplistic situation there. I'd like yep. to use that to kind of segue on to a couple of areas where you and I have been on panels and sometimes on the same side yep. and sometimes on contrasting sides. unconditional offers in the UK, again, an area which I think probably, if I paid for expensive software, I can work out how many times you'd featured in newspapers over the last 3 years. I think unconditional offers would probably be the topic you've been asked to yeah. speak on most. Very briefly, sort of, you know, how has the HMCGSA Universities Committee engaged with that topic, and where do things kind of stand for it now, given that politicians have sort of latched onto it?
Well, it's a great question. You're absolutely right. It's been one of the big themes, although it's kind of, if I look back over my time on this group, it's kind of emerged as a theme and almost, I think, burnt itself out as we are here now in 2020. So really, when the HE sector expanded, so along with that tripling of tuition fees when Lord Willetts was Universities Minister and Nick Hillman was his special advisor, the tripling of tuition fees went alongside the abolition of student number controls. And for people who may not know this, up until that point, in around about 2010, 2011, until that point, the universities were strictly controlled in the number of students they were allowed to admit because the state was paying most of the fee. So with the tripling of the fees, the abolition of student number controls, a lot of really great universities thought, great, well, we'll expand, like any business, saying, you know, we've got the ability to take more students, they're paying their own fee through the student loans, this is a great business model. And arguably, some of them expanded too much, and the supply of 18-year-olds wasn't as high as people thought, or the supply of 18-year-olds wanting to go to university. So giving unconditional offers was a kind of market way of filling spaces. And no matter how much universities justified it by saying we wanted to take the stress away from students by, you know, making it clear they could come, whatever their A-level results, we trust them to get great A-level results. The reality was that giving an unconditional offer to an applicant before they'd even taken their A-levels, most offers obviously are conditional on a particular A-level or whatever performance, giving an unconditional offer was a way of filling your spaces. And schools were pretty cross about it, because if you can imagine, you've got your year 13 students and some of them say, well, I'm into this university without whatever I get, whatever my grades. So schools felt that this was not helpful, and also gave a sort of an unhelpful wedge between some of your upper sixth, your year 13 pupils who had to work for their ABB or whatever it was to get to a certain university, alongside others in the same class who didn't have to work because they didn't need the grade. And that's not a helpful sort of scenario. It's not a very fair upper sixth, year 13 sort of landscape to teach in. So we made all these points to universities. And I think that what's happened is that universities have realized that the students who come through on unconditional offers, I don't think they perform any worse than the others, but they don't perform any better. And now they don't particularly take up unconditional offers. Yes. I think in one of the pieces I wrote, I quoted the sort of old Groucho Marx line, I wouldn't want to belong to a club that wanted me. And it's a little bit like, you know, if a university's made me an unconditional offer, I'm not sure I really want to go there. So I think we're seeing the decline, or will over the next year or so see the decline. But it's been a very interesting sort of market process to observe.
I mean, I deeply appreciate your sort of thoughts on the process there, Chris. And I think, yeah, the bit that you say, that it was a response to a different climate. It was a market-driven response, and the market has now moved through it. And I can't help but think that as the demographics in the UK are switching around, and it's suddenly going to be a fact that universities can be pickier because there are just more kids coming through the system, that, yeah. you know, I don't think it's a... it's a surprise and probably almost is correlation between the fact that universities feared that they were going to go bust and found new ways of trying to keep their numbers healthy for a couple of years. And,
yeah,
and now
yeah,
there,
yeah.
Just, there are more kids to choose between, and then they can be pickier and we'll see all sorts of interesting other ways of doing it. So,
yeah,
so
I think
indeed,
that's right.
Yeah. Great. I'm conscious of your time and that you've got all sorts of other things to do at school. I'd just like to ask you quickly then based on your deep involvement in this and seeing it from a number of different perspectives, what do you think we might have to look for in the future? And I don't necessarily just mean particular things that will happen, but where might the debate go over the next couple of years?
That's really interesting. I mean, I was thinking of this, and you kindly sort of indicated that this might be something we would cover. I was kind of thinking it in a few things that I hope will happen, and a few things that I think might happen, and perhaps we sort of cover it that way if that's okay.
That's fine with me.
One of the things I really hope, and I'm thinking here about my own sector, the sort of independent school sector, although I think it would go for the maintained sector as well. One of the things I really hope is that we will become less conservative, with a small c, obviously not politically conservative. But one of the things that really struck me quite early on in my time as chair of this group was a presentation given by the then chief executive of UCAS, Mary Kernock-Cook, who's a great, fantastic commentator on the sector, and even though she's not at UCAS anymore, still is. And she gave a presentation at the sort of annual heads conference, where we'd all been used to being told how successful our schools are at getting great entry figures into really good universities. And she said, yeah, you are, but let's look at what they do and where they go. And something like 85% of young men and women leaving independent schools go to only 10% of the available places that they could go. And they study only about 10% of the available courses. In other words, they're going to the same old places, doing the same old things year after year. And she challenged the group of heads and said, look, you know, do you not realize there are some fantastic new courses, I don't know, animation, ethical hacking, international relations, that kind of thing. And your students, she said, don't do these things, and some of them should. And I'd put in that as well, that we thought, again, back in around about 2010-11, that one of the things that might happen is our students might go more international. And they might go to the States more, they might go to Europe more. And we actually had two or three meetings of my committee, much to the some mockery and fun poking of other heads. We had a meeting in Maastricht, we had a meeting in Milan, we had a meeting in Leiden, places where you can study in English. You can study economics in English, you can study medicine in English, and so on and so forth. And that ability to go wider than the simple UK HE market for our 18-year-olds hasn't really got much traction with them. So I hope that'll change, and I hope also that students will carry on getting better and better prepared for university, and that the demands of A-level, in particular, very closely guided, very sort of prescribed demands will not mean that our students don't prepare themselves for independent thinking at university. And I guess my I have one practical hope for the future, which is that the government will sort out some sensible arrangement on interest on fees, because I think the interest being charged to students on their fees is absurdly high. So those are kind of some. But what do I think will happen? I think the sector, the HE sector, will be pretty resilient. I think things will be pretty slow to change. I think that the debate may move away from the analysis of a teaching excellence framework in sort of statistical terms and more towards some more qualitative analysis of how good the experience is in universities, and I think that would be a good thing. And I suppose the other thing I think, you know, maybe the debate will, now that we have a government which says it is committed to the regions, the non-London regions of the UK, maybe the debate will start to focus on the big civics, the Manchesters, the Birminghams, the Leeds, those kinds of universities, and see whether they can really step up to the challenge of perhaps even starting to challenge Oxbridge.
Yeah.
And I think that would be really interesting as well.
Great, Chris. So lots of fascinating stuff in there, and I agree with you on all the things that you've said in there. And I do hope, you know, I'm particularly interesting as you know, anyone who delves into student finance in great detail will look at that and go, that's, you know, however much you might disagree about all the different bits of it, that's one thing that it's very hard to argue is a positive development. Some really powerful hopes in there, and I appreciate you laying them forwards. This work will obviously, you know, continue in the HMC GSA committee without
Absolutely,
you, that
yeah.
Your term is ending. So, but I hope that you'll find a new Twitter handle and we'll still be able to share the benefits of your reading and things. But for the sake of people who do want to just kind of get a sense of how you sort of poke and prod the debate a little bit, but also share interesting articles, where can people find you on Twitter if they want to join your family?
So at @HMC_higher ed is, and I'm going to hand that over to my successor Nick Weaver, because it's not really a personal feed, it's more a sort of on behalf of the sector, and I you're absolutely right, I will find another one to hopefully get my followers. When I joined Twitter, I remember somebody saying, follow other people and they'll follow you. So that worked first time.
Great stuff. Fantastic. Well, Chris, thanks so much for your time and the benefit of your insight. And I'm sure, like me, all the listeners have very much appreciated it.
Oh, thank you, David. Always a great pleasure, and all the best to you and everybody listening.
If you do advise students on applying to universities in the UK and you didn't follow Chris's previous account, please do find his new account. It really is a source of absolute wisdom, nuggets of information on all sorts of things going on in UK higher education. I've said it a few times, but I think I can say it again. A huge thanks to Chris for all the work that he's done, and I'm sure will continue to do in the future. Thanks again for listening to another episode of the University Guide podcast. Please follow me on social media. Please subscribe to the podcast and check out my website, theuniversityguide.com. All sorts of interesting resources on international university admissions.